This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Tracy, nice to see you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
You know, the unfortunate part of this time of the year, first of all, it's a wonderful time of year, mm-hmm. No question about that. But everybody is hurried, they're harried, they're stressed out, and I want to point out to people and have people remember that more fatal heart attacks occur on Christmas Day than any other day of the year.
It's all that hustle and bustle.
That's right. It's the Christmas coronary, as they call it.
Oh, really?
And the second most common day is the day after Christmas.
I remember that.
And the third most common day is January 1st, after
a big
night of New Year's Eve. So, fun time of year.
Settle down.
Yep, with family and friends, but you have to be careful.
Well, I know you've probably been working on your meditation techniques all year long, and so you'll have it all in hand this year.
Dr. Amit Sood's book.
Yeah, that's
everybody
right.
Everybody should get that.
That's
It'll
right.
Be stress-free holidays.
It's a great Christmas gift.
Well, as we look back at the year 2014, we remember that there were some exciting advances in the world of medicine, and most of those you have heard about right here on Mayo Clinic Radio, and it's time to look back at the exciting events of 2014 in the field of medicine.
Yeah, it's one of the best parts about this job.
Uh-huh.
Today, we're going to hear about just a few of those stories, starting with a less invasive way to test for colon cancer. We'll talk about using the measles vaccine to fight against cancer, enlisting robots to help, and your smartphone, by the way, to help diagnose patients suffering from stroke or concussion, and using stem cells to unravel the mysteries of ALS. So we've got a lot to talk about. And our first guest is already here. Good morning to Dr. David Ahlquist.
Morning, Dr. Ahlquist. Good to have you on the program.
Yeah, good morning, Tom and Tracy.
First of all, congratulations. You made it to the finish line with the Cologuard test. Fantastic. Tell us about that. And by the way, our audience should know that this was named the best of what's new in 2014 by the editors of Popular Science magazine. Congratulations, David.
Yeah, well, thank you, Tom. And it was the culmination of the efforts of many people on our research team and our industry collaborators at Exact Sciences. So we're very excited by the lives that this test will touch.
Well, first, can you tell us first, what did colon cancer testing used to be like? That's the problem.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, you know, there was a gap. You know, colon cancer continued to be the number two cancer killer in this country in the face of the existing screening tools. And the tools were included colonoscopy, which is a very good approach, but it's invasive, fecal blood testing, non-invasive but not very accurate, and flexible sigmoidoscopy, which looks at only the lower third of the colon and doesn't look at the right side at all.
So it's a mini colonoscopy.
Yeah, right. And so there was this gap that existed. The tests that were available were either invasive, where many patients chose not to use screening because of that, or they weren't very accurate. The innovation that stool DNA testing, the commercial test is called Cologuard, brings is that it's very accurate, it's easy to use, and it's available through the mail. So, you know, those are the ideal characteristics, and this test has the same accuracy as colonoscopy does for early curable stage cancer, 94% for stage 1 and stage 2 cancer.
I haven't had a colonoscopy yet. And so I was very excited about this discovery. But, you know, I've heard many times from people that it's not really the colonoscopy itself that's the tough part. It was the prep that was the tough part.
Mm-hmm.
And why was the prep the tough part?
Well, you know, for several reasons, both practical and comfort-wise. Practically, it does require often 1 to 2 days of missed work time. The colon has to be cleaned of stool, and that usually requires an oral laxative that takes a while to accomplish. And the preparation also involves dietary restrictions and medication restrictions. None of it is necessary with the Cologuard test. There's no prep. you don't change your diet, your medications, or cleanse your colon. You go about your daily business. You don't have to miss work or your daily activities.
So what do you do with the Cologuard
test? First of all, it has to be ordered by your physician, correct?
Yes, it does.
And then what happens from there?
Well, a test kit is sent to your home or the place of your designation, and you deposit a stool sample in a bucket that mounts to the toilet seat. It's pretty simple, and the lid of the bucket is after making the deposit is tightened securely, and that same bucket is used to mail back to the lab.
So you don't have to take a piece of stool. I mean, you can do the whole thing and put it in there.
Well, the reason being is that it makes for a more accurate determination.
Okay, the more stool, the better.
Yeah, exactly. Oh.
And so then someone gets the mail at their laboratory, mm-hmm. and does a DNA test on the stool.
What's very different, right? The test measures blood in the stool as well, but many polyps or many cancers, and the large majority of polyps don't bleed. So blood, if that's all you measured, you miss many of the lesions. This test also detects DNA changes that are shed off of the surface of cancer and polyps, and that makes for a very accurate test. The result is generated in the laboratory, and the information is sent to the patient's healthcare provider.
So if you get a negative test, you're home free. If not, then you probably then need to go in and get some kind of invasive test.
Colonoscopy would be the next step, yes.
Okay, but if your test is negative, you don't have to have the colonoscopy.
No. In fact, the frequency of screening based on what we've done as far as cost-effectiveness modeling, and Medicare and insurance companies have done the same thing, the sweet spot seems to be about every 3 years. So that's if you would choose to continue with Cologuard screening, you would not have to do anything for another 3 years.
So in 2015, if you're set to, and you should be, getting your colon check done, you can ask your doctor that this is that you want to have a Cologuard?
Yes.
Now, I know that this test has just recently been FDA approved and become available. What's the acceptance been so far?
Tom, the test became available after FDA approval in October, and every metric that we've followed has exceeded the expectation in terms of the number of physicians registered to order and order the test, the number of patients requesting the test. It's the level of enthusiasm over this test has been extraordinary.
Phenomenal, and I can see why.
Yeah, well, I want to take a step way back, because I've been hearing about this theory that you've been working on, uh-huh. this practice, going through all. Can you just tell us, from someone having the idea to do this, through all of the testing that you do, what is that timeline? What's it like to have an idea, go through the research, all the way to FDA approval in October?
Yeah, well, at the front end of innovation, Tracy, there is this sort of creative dance that you go through, and the concept of DNA shedding or exfoliating from polyps and cancer as a better approach happened, about 20 years ago, and that seemed like a good concept. But the challenge at that point was there was no technology to actually measure that DNA, and so it's taken 20 years to optimize the technology and deliver the biological promise of the idea, and that's taken, a disciplined team with really hard, careful science to get to where we are now.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is now covered by insurance and by Medicare, and the test costs approximately $500.
Yes, that's right, Tom. The Medicare covers it. This was the first time Medicare ever did an approval at the same time as FDA approval. Normally, they waited for FDA, and then they started their review. They did a parallel review. That's never happened before.
And what does a colonoscopy cost?
Well, by Medicare and by private insurance, the price range is probably between about $1,000 and over $3,000.
It varies considerably throughout the country, doesn't it?
And Medicare chose to cover it for essentially the full amount. There's just a little bit of difference. They're covering it for $502. And at every 3 years, that ends up being very cost effective. The way we measure how the value that a screening test takes to the population is called cost effectiveness, and the cost effectiveness for this test is much better than screening mammography, cervical pap smearing, those common screening targets based on Medicare's own data. So we're very pleased with that. Insurance companies, not all of them covered at this point. That's still evolving. You know, the test just has been made available for patients. The natural history is Medicare approves it first, then the other insurance companies. Many insurance companies have already elected to cover it, but I think that will evolve over the next several months.
Well, Dr. Ahlquist, I don't know if this is makes you feel warms your heart or not, but for the rest of my life, whenever I have my Cologuard test done, I'll think of you.
Cologuard, nothing less than a significant breakthrough in healthcare in
Amazing.
America. And once again, named the best of what's new in 2014 by the editors of Popular Science magazine. Dr. David Ahlquist, really appreciate you being with us. And again, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Fabulous work.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom and Tracy.
Time for a short break. Coming up, we're going to talk about robots used in patient care, a potential cancer cure from an unexpected immunization, and another use for stem cells.
And a heartwarming story about Stacy, where cancer was potentially cured with a vaccine. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae, and it's the end of the year show, and we're talking about exciting advances in the world of medicine, which happened in the year 2014. And up next, we're going to talk about robots and telemedicine.
That's
how
right.
Mayo can actually diagnose and potentially treat stroke victims from miles away.
The director of Mayo Clinic Telestroke Program in Arizona, Dr. Bart Damershall, is on the line. Good morning, Dr. Damershall.
Morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I first have to say, the first time I ever heard about robots helping with stroke treatment, I thought, you know, I imagine Rosie from the Jetsons, but I don't think that's what the robot that we're talking about looks like, is it?
Well, it bears some similarities, but certainly more sophisticated. Interestingly, some of the users of that robot actually nickname it Rosie.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So what was the impetus for instituting a program like you have down in Arizona?
Well, the principal impetus was the realization that, in fact, up to 40 or 50% of residents in the United States across multiple states simply don't have direct access to emergency neurological care. So on average, nearly 40% of Americans don't live in proximity to a major neurological center where there are neurology and neurosurgery and neuroradiological experts that can manage a neurological emergency like stroke. And traditionally, what would happen is patients presenting to these facilities without direct access to neurology care would be transported by air or ground ambulance to a major urban, metropolitan, or academic neurological center, but would often be arriving simply too late for emergency treatment to be rendered.
Why is it important to treat early?
Well, for the case of stroke, time is brain. That's the relevant slogan, which is to emphasize to the public that with every minute that elapses, neurons or brain cells die. So when an artery is blocked in the brain, immediately there is irreparable damage, and that irreparable damage extends with every elapsed minute. The treatments to try and bust open that clot are relevant and applicable and safe and effective as early as possible after the stroke occurs, traditionally within the first 3 hours, and in some cases up to 4.5 hours. There are some There are additional treatments that may be applicable up to 6 or 8 hours, but fewer and fewer people are eligible for such. So in other words, the earlier the treatment, the better. And when patients are transported sometimes hundreds of miles by ground or air, they'll arrive outside of those applicable time windows and emergency treatment can't be rendered. So telemedicine tried to turn the idea onto its head, and rather than transporting the patient hundreds of miles to a neurological center, the idea is to transport the experts virtually to the patient with live, synchronous, robotic and non-robotic telemedicine applications.
So how does a neurologist use technology to examine a patient? How do you teleport, quote-unquote, an exam? How does that work?
Yes, it's interesting. So the technology is really sophisticated. Some of the most sophisticated pieces we use are referred to as robotic telemedicine. And essentially, these are computers, a sophisticated video conferencing system, a very powerful zoom, pan, tilt camera, and the opportunity to actually install devices such as stethoscopes and ophthalmoscopes and otoscopes into the robot. So what you have to imagine is the patient with symptoms and signs of stroke presenting to a rural hospital without neurological expertise. And that patient, of course, has access to excellent emergency physicians and emergency nurses and usually a laboratory and a CT scan or CAT scan of the brain. But what they don't have is a neurologist to be part of that member of the team. So at the bedside of the patient is where the robot exists. And these robots can be driven remotely. So imagine that I may be at the Mayo Clinic Hospital in Phoenix, Arizona. The patient is in a rural setting. The robot is with the patient. And I might be on my computer desktop. I could be at home working from my home office on a laptop. I could be between centers working from an iPad or a laptop with a hotspot, so Wi-Fi connectivity. And I can remotely drive that robot. So either with a joystick or devices, I can move the robot, drive it forward, backward, turn. I can go down corridors, elevators. I can move within a facility to the patient's bedside. Typically, it's housed in an emergency department or a critical care unit. In addition to that, then I can operate the zoom, pan, tilt camera to really give myself the perspective of the entire environment. I can immerse myself in that environment. So I can, in a live fashion, I can hear what the patient, the family, the nurse, the doctors are telling me. They can hear me directly. We can have conversations. The examination itself is a very systematic, focused neurological examination called the National Institute of Health Stroke Scale, which has been proven to be reliable and valid as conducted by live telemedicine, just as it can be conducted by a live neurologist at the bedside. And it essentially asks several questions regarding the patient's level of consciousness and alertness and ability to understand and communicate. Then we look at the cranial nerves, essentially the way the eyes and the face may move, the strength in the limbs, the sensation in the limbs, and coordination and cerebellar function. So it's a very focused examination. It may take no more than approximately 5 to 7 minutes to conduct, and most of it is visually inspection and audio. Now, the bedside nurses and physicians assist the neurologist to do any component that the neurologist may require for touch. So, for example, testing sensation with a Kleenex or a safety pin, they serve as the neurologist an extension. And there are several other elements of the examination that require their assistance. So you can imagine that providers at the bedside with medical providers, the neurologist at a distance, through that sophisticated technology, gain an understanding of the patient's symptoms and signs. And then on top of that, we have access to the patient's brain imaging. So those images are transmitted by teleradiology and become part of our workstation. So we can see and hear the patient, the nurses, the family, the doctor. We have access to their laboratory reports, and we can visually inspect the CAT scan or the MRI scan of their brain to help the local doctors arrive at a diagnosis and an emergency management plan.
It's important.
So what you're what you're trying to do here is it's a stroke is like a heart attack in that there's a blood clot that has blocked a blood vessel to the brain. You're trying to help the physicians who are caring for this patient miles away figure out where that clot is and help them dissolve it before the brain cells die.
Exactly it. That's
and because all rural hospitals or nursing homes, they don't just have a neurologist hanging around. And so that's what helps get this neurology component out to those areas.
That's right. I wish the determination of the diagnosis of stroke and the suitability to use a clot-busting medication was easy, but it's not always so easy. There are many other conditions that mimic stroke, and a neurologist partnered with an emergency physician can be much better together as a team trying to tease out stroke from stroke mimickers. And then the second issue is determining eligibility for this clot-busting medication, which is not without some risk. So one wants to be sure that we're selecting the patients that are most likely to benefit and least likely to suffer any adverse effects.
We have about 30 seconds left, but there is a component of this that's used on the sideline for concussion for football. And is it the same way that the neurologist is looking at those things on the sidelines?
That's exactly it. It's a very similar theme. There simply aren't sufficient numbers of sports neurologists, concussion experts to be at the sideline of every athletic competition, in this case for speaking about college football. So Mayo Clinic has partnered with Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, and with Robotic Telemedicine ensures that there is a concussion neurologist participating
Dr. Damershall,
on the sidelines.
Yeah, we are out of time. We thank you so much for your experience and for sharing it with us.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Cervical cancer is a great example of how screening can save lives. Because of the pap smear, cervical cancer deaths decreased a lot in the U.S. Better treatments have increased survival rates, and now a vaccine can prevent it. But thousands of women still die from the disease every year. Now, researchers from Central South University in China have shown that something called photoacoustic imaging may be a faster, cheaper way to diagnose and stage cervical cancer. It works by being able to distinguish cancerous tissue from normal cells. The researchers say the test is non-invasive and can help doctors see cancers that current methods can't. They say more research is needed, but their work shows this technique has the potential to make better diagnoses to help save lives. Their work is published in the journal Biomedical Optics Express. And now let's talk about breast cancer. Mayo Clinic doctors discourage the use of a certain type of genetic testing that's been used to help guide tamoxifen therapy. They say studies on the gene called CYP2D6 have been flawed, and women who were thought to benefit from the drug may not. Here's Dr. Matthew Goetz from Mayo Clinic.
What we found was that up to 45% of breast cancers contain what's called loss of heterozygosity at the CYP2D6 gene. What does that mean? It means that if you use the tumor to genotype for CYP2D6, you get it wrong a substantial proportion of the time.
Now again, some women with deficiencies in this gene metabolize tamoxifen differently, making it less effective. Doctors say use of this gene testing to guide therapy should be carefully reconsidered. This was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. And now, don't skip meals. You've likely heard that before, especially if you're trying to shed some pounds. Well, new research from the University of Eastern Finland shows kids who skip meals are more likely to have excess body fat and an increased cardiometabolic risk. This goes for kids as young as ages 6 or 8. And the more kids have sugary drinks, red meat, low-fat margarine, and not much vegetable oil, the more these risk factors increase. Plus, how they ate mattered. Eating fat
fast, emotional overeating, and not feeling full when they should were also associated with higher body fat. The researchers say, based on their findings, sticking to regular meals seems to be key for preventing overweight and related diseases in childhood. And this was published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the International Journal of Obesity, and European Journal of Nutrition. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back, Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McRae, and we're talking about the significant, the major, the best medical advances in the year 2014. And joining us in studio is hematologist, blood expert, Dr. Stephen Russell. Dr. Russell, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
We had you on earlier. You had an exciting story to tell. And we want you to tell it again.
Absolutely. My favorite show of the whole year of 2014 was when Dr. Russell was in with Stacey Erholtz and explained to us what you and Stacey accomplished.
Well, Stacey was the first person ever with disseminated cancer that had spread throughout her body, to receive a virus intravenously that attacked the cancer and caused it to completely regress.
Now, remind us what kind of cancer she had.
She had multiple myeloma, which is a form of bone and blood cancer that is spread throughout the body right from the get-go. And she actually had, we looked at her bone marrow and it was diffusely infiltrated with the myeloma cells.
Cancer everywhere.
And we did a PET scan and she had five tumors. One of those tumors she had named
Evan.
It was called Evan.
Yeah, I remember him.
It was a golf ball sized tumor growing out of the left side of her forehead.
And that's why her kids named it, because it was very obvious, this tumor growing out of the side of her face.
It was, yeah.
And so what did you do to Stacey?
for
Stacey.
Yeah, for Stacey.
By the way, I presume that she had been through all of the traditional treatments, which are much better than they used to be, but still myeloma is a difficult disease to treat.
She had become resistant to all the available anti-myeloma drugs at the time, and she had had two stem cell transplants.
Wow.
And she was 8 months out from her second stem cell transplant, and this myeloma was progressing very rapidly, and the tumor on her forehead was growing fast. So we gave her an intravenous infusion of measles virus, the vaccine strain of measles virus that we had engineered to make it more suitable for cancer therapy. And it was equivalent to 10 million doses of the vaccine.
A super-duper dose of measles vaccine. Is what took care of Evan.
Yep, absolutely. And the virus, once within her body, it infected and killed many of the tumor cells. But then we think her immune system continued the fight against the cancer and mopped up any residual cells that had escaped the virus infection.
And so that's viral therapy is what it's called. I learned that this year.
That's correct.
So just like I asked Dr. Ahlquist, what is it that gives you the idea to use a virus to fight cancer? How does that even come about?
Viruses destroy tissue. Naturally, virus infections destroy something.
Mm-hmm.
Flu virus destroys the lung, hepatitis destroys the liver, HIV destroys the immune system, so why not have a virus that specifically destroys a cancer?
Well, why did you pick chickenpox?
Well, measles.
I mean, measles, sorry.
Chickenpox would be an interesting one to test.
That's next, huh?
But we picked measles because there had been a report of a child in Uganda several years back who had a measles infection that led to complete regression of a lymphoma that he had growing behind his eye.
Wow.
Similar type tumor in a way, a cousin of myeloma.
And it was just a spontaneous thing that was observed, and he never had any treatment for the tumor. So we knew there was something there. We didn't want to use the wild type virus because it's dangerous. So we moved on the vaccine strain, and it turned out to work like a dream. Serendipity, really, because when the vaccine was made, the way in which the virus was weakened was by teaching it to grow on cancer cells in the lab. So it became in unable to cause disease in a patient, but nevertheless had acquired this ability to kill cancer cells very efficiently.
Another one of the things I learned when you and Stacy were here was that something I hadn't considered. If you're going to give somebody 10 million times the dose, whatever that math is that you were saying, that you need to have a whole lot of measles vaccine just lying around the place, which is not necessarily the case. And so that's an interesting part of going forward. If you can figure out ways to use viruses to combat cancer, you're going to need a whole lot more vaccinations. Vaccines sitting around. How does that whole part of this story fit in?
Manufacturing has been absolutely the key to allow us to do this. And we have a great manufacturing facility at Mayo. We have a fantastic group of people working on manufacturing. And they've developed methods that allow them to produce enormous quantities of the virus. And without that backup, we wouldn't be able to do this study. It's still a challenge to make the amount of virus that we're giving to each individual patient, but we can do it.
And we should say there is a new trial since the last time that you were here in this summer. A new trial began in October. How is that going? How many patients are part of that trial?
So to date, we've enrolled 13 patients. We haven't treated all of those patients. The trial opened on October the 1st, and we are really moving very aggressively to treat as many patients in a short period of time as we can. Everyone's working around the clock. We're learning a huge amount. We're learning how long the virus persists in the body, whether it's shed in the urine and saliva, for how long that happens. And we're learning about its response. So the moment we don't have another Stacy, we don't have another amazing, dramatic response, but that's the goal of this study.
And her amazing story prompted a lot of people with multiple myeloma to contact you. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The phone lines were hopping, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. So it was how long ago that you gave the measles vaccine to Stacy?
18 months.
And how is she doing?
She is doing absolutely fantastic. I saw her on Tuesday. And she, by the way, sends her regards.
And you know, Dr. Shives, you weren't here to meet Stacy, but one of the things that is so cool about her is that she went on to start a foundation to help raise money for producing more vaccine, correct?
She did, yeah.
She was heartbroken to think that there might be somebody else in her shoes that would qualify for this type of a study. Medically could qualify for it, but then there wouldn't be the vaccines there to do the treatment. And so that's what she's spending her time now. These 18 months is raising money to help with vaccine production.
Yeah.
She's
now, the
great.
Other patients that you have treated, have they all responded somewhat to the measles vaccine, but not necessarily as well as Stacy did?
Really too early to report back on that. Not everybody is responding.
Interesting, huh?
Honestly, yeah. It's early. What we plan to do is an interim analysis of the study in January, after we've treated our first 13 patients, and then we'll reopen the study in March, and we'll tweak it and change the way we're using the virus according to what we've learned.
Because if I remember right, it's not just that you have multiple myeloma that gets you qualified for this study. You also have to have, what is your relationship with that vaccine? You already have to have been vaccinated. How does that work?
We only are giving the virus to people who have no anti-measles antibody in their blood because we know that that will destroy the therapy before it reaches the cancer.
And do you hope, what's the next cancer that you hope to tack on to multiple myeloma, and what's the next one that you could fight?
Well, we already have trials ongoing in patients with ovarian cancer, brain cancer, head and neck cancer, and mesothelioma.
Isn't that awesome?
So we
really
have a lot
incredible
going on.
And it what's interesting also is that some of the medical discoveries are completely fortuitous, like this one, what someone observed that someone with lymphoma was basically cured or their disease was improved because they got the measles.
Yep.
Reminds me of the Viagra story.
They were giving
Viagra to mice to treat high blood pressure and noticed they all had erections. There you go.
Unusual side effect that resulted. Well, Dr. Russell, I hope that you keep us in going into 2015, keep us posted on how this and how your research goes. I just think it's so exciting and wonderful. And I know that Stacy's listening. So best wishes, Stacy. Merry Christmas to you.
Thank
Thanks
you
for being here.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Stephen Russell, glad to have you.
Thanks so much. And speaking of research and using something in a way that had not previously been used, Dr. Anthony Windebank is on the line. And we spoke with him later, I guess it was this fall, about ALS after the bucket challenge. Remember, everybody did the bucket challenge in August.
That went through my family. I watched them.
Good for you.
It looked a little cold to me.
Dr. Windebank, good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
Morning, Dr. Windebank. Thanks so much for being with us. Yeah. You know, that bucket challenge, that was huge. I mean, how many million dollars were raised?
I think it was about $130 million in the U.S. and then a lot in other countries as well.
Yeah, it went around the world.
Yeah.
So, first of all, explain to us what ALS is and what it does to a patient. We know that that's what Lou Gehrig had, and that's kind of what started us off talking about it the last time that you were here. But what is ALS?
So ALS is a disease of the nerve cells that control your movement. So these nerve cells that live in the spinal cord and in the brain start to die prematurely, much faster than they should and much faster than any other cells in the body. And nerve cells don't regenerate themselves very well. So as you lose these motor nerve cells, then you get paralysis of the muscles that control your arms and legs, and most importantly, that control things like swallowing and breathing. So it causes progressive weakness and loss of function, and then eventually difficulty breathing. And most patients die on average about 2 years after the diagnosis.
Now, much like Dr. Russell, you started some research into ways that you could make life better for the ALS patients, maybe if not cure them, at least to help their life, help them. And that is using stem cells. So explain a little bit about what your research is and what you're doing.
Certainly. So we're using stem cells that we get from the patient themselves. So this is a question of trying to help the body to heal itself. And the stem cells that we're getting are ones that live all over your body, but especially in the bone marrow and in your fat tissue. And the easiest place to get them from is actually the fat tissue. So when we're going to treat a patient, we do a little mini liposuction and take out about an ounce of fat tissue, take that to the lab, and grow out a lot of stem cells from it. Now, these stem cells in the body are there to help the body heal. So whenever you injure something, for example, injure your skin or a muscle, these cells will travel through the body to that area, and they'll kind of initiate and help the healing process. Unfortunately, they don't get into the brain and spinal cord normally. Hmm. They're very the brain and the spinal cord is very protected by something called the blood-brain barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're doing is growing up these healing cells, and then we bring the patient back in about 6 weeks later, and we give an injection of the cells into the spinal fluid. And they kind of take up residence there, and what we hope is that they then produce healing factors which will prevent the nerve cells from dying.
So I'm going to put the two of you together. What Dr. Russell is doing is using a vaccine to attack and kill the cancer cells. You are using stem cells to help build up what the ALS is degenerating.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So what are they? Tell us about the early results.
Well, we've got two trials going on at the moment. The first is what's called a dose escalation safety study. This is a very radical new kind of treatment. So the first thing we have to understand is whether the stem cells are going to cause any harm. We're putting them in a place where they're not normally present in the body. So what we do is we take the first group of patients and give them a small dose, and then each group of patients gets a slightly larger dose and a slightly larger dose and until you get up to what's called the maximum tolerated dose. We've almost finished that study. We've enrolled about 21 of the 25 patients. And so far, the safety profile is extremely good. The second thing that we're seeing is that the cells We think there are good clues that the cells are taking up residence as we expected them to. We can see some changes on the MRI images of the nerve roots that suggest the cells are making a home there. And they're surviving a surprisingly long time. A lot of other stem cell studies, for example, in heart disease, show that the cells last for a couple of weeks and disappear.
Wow.
We're seeing them survive for months and months in the spinal space. Now, there's a lot more work done to establish that for sure, but that's optimistic. And as I said, the safety profile's been very good. In this kind of study, we can't talk about, and we're not looking for whether they're working or not. Certainly, patients are saying they're feeling good, but that's not what we're doing in the first study.
Is your goal at this point in time to improve the symptoms or to actually potentially cure the patient or extend their life?
First of all, it's to extend their life. We're treating patients as early as possible in the disease, and the idea is to try and stop it from progressing. If we can stop it from progressing, that would be absolutely wonderful, because in most cases, you can make the diagnosis pretty definitely before somebody's seriously disabled.
It's fair to say, isn't it, that up until now, there has basically been no treatment for ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease.
Absolutely. Lou Gehrig was in a clinical trial 75 years ago at Mayo Clinic. I think there have been about 40 drug trials. We've actually done some of them at Mayo, and these are things that have been very promising early on in experimental models like mice with Lou Gehrig's disease. And then when we brought them into the patient, they've just failed completely.
You know, it is such a devastating, difficult, tragic disease with a very ugly end to it. And it's interesting, isn't it, that it's one of those diseases that has defied every attempt we have made to try and treat it.
Absolutely. And it is a terrible disease, but on the other hand, I am always incredibly impressed by how people and their families, you know, over that 2 to 3 year period during the deterioration, kind of come to terms with it and come to peace with it. And it's extraordinary, the resilience that you see
and
in people.
To circle it back around, money raised through that ice bucket challenge may make its way into research to help with this stem cell research. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's one of the exciting things that's happened, actually, in the last year. So there's money from the ice bucket challenge. Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, is putting money into regenerative medicine research, so we're asking them for support for additional trials.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Winterbank. We appreciate you being with us today, and another ice bucket challenge maybe next year.
Well, yeah. We'll wait for that. Happy holidays.
Very impressive. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. We're back right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I tell you, it was a great year, wasn't it?
It's just, you know, when we race through, we're talking to four experts about these stories that one after the other is more amazing and jaw-dropping than the last.
You know, I don't know which one I like the best. The Cologuard thing is such a major advance. And do you realize that half of people over the age of 50 who should be getting screened either aren't getting screened or not as recommended? And only 40% of colon cancers today are caught early. And that's the whole key. If you don't smoke, colon cancer is the cancer that's most likely to take your life.
Well, if you would like more information about that or about maybe being part of the studies that Dr. Russell and Dr. Winterbank are part of, if you just want to learn more about it, you can go to mayoclinic.org. And there are you could spend the rest of the afternoon just clicking around and looking different things on there. You can do some Christmas shopping on there. There's all sorts of things. But you can also access a podcast of today's program, as well as our previous episodes. And we should say that there are over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic that will help you better manage your health and learn more about what we talked about today.
Right. A special thanks to Dr. David Ahlquist, Dr. Stephen Russell, Dr. Anthony Winterbank, and Dr. Bart Darmershall. It was a great hour. You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Rich Dietman, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and all the physicians at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester and Florida and Arizona, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.